Athletic.
This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For almost 15 years, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring third-party research on a broad range of public management issues facing us today. Measuring program performance is relatively straightforward in many areas of government, such as social services, visa processing, and air traffic control. But in some instances, assessing performance and success is much harder. One particularly difficult area involves law enforcement, where a key goal is to prevent or deter bad outcomes, which can often happen without the knowledge of law enforcement officials. Cracking the challenge of measuring unobserved behaviors, drug smuggling, tax fraud, counterfeiting, and illegal immigration is a key to developing better strategies and targeting resources in the right places to catch and deter illegal actions. What are the challenges of measuring unobserved events? How do unobserved events differ from infrequent events? Are there data estimation methods that can assist public managers in measuring unobserved events? And what agencies are applying such methods to develop appropriate data-driven strategies and approaches? Today, we'll explore these questions and more with John Whitley, author of the IBM Center Report, Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events, a case study of federal law enforcement. John, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So, John, before we delve into your report for the IBM Center, Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events, a case study of federal law enforcement, I'd like to get some context around the concept of performance management. What is performance management measurement, and why is it so important that federal agencies measure program performance?
Mm-hmm. Well, I come at this problem really as a practitioner, so I don't have I'm not going to be able to provide the best theoretical framework here, and I'm sure the academic literature covers that very well. But in my experience, I've worked in large federal agencies, really largely in the resource allocation and programmatic decision-making areas, where we've supported the senior leadership in trying to decide how to allocate their resources, what things to be investing in. So my coming into performance is really in that context. How do we say, what do you get for this investment option? What do you get for this investment option, or for A or for B or for C? And so I really came into performance measurement first and foremost in trying to measure that return. Return on investment, but return at the strategic level of the organization. What are we trying to get if we go in this direction or that direction? When I went to DHS, Department of Homeland Security, as the performance improvement officer, it became even more apparent to me there. We were trying to determine, DHS has a wide range of missions, immigration, counterterrorism, disaster management, cybersecurity. We were trying to allocate resources across these various missions, and we had to get a sense of what are we trying to achieve in these areas, and what are we trying to, and what would it get if we invested in this program or that program.
You've mentioned outcomes. We've talked about performance measures. I want to get a sense of what they are in practical terms. So what is a performance measure, and how does it differ from an outcome measure?
So I view this thing very very simply: inputs, outputs, outcomes. Inputs being the things you buy, outputs being the widgets that are produced, and outcomes being the things that you're trying to affect with those widgets. Outcomes generally are affected by environmental relative economic growth of the, on either side of the border. Other things are affecting the outcomes as well, in addition to the government activities, the government outputs being produced. And then I usually just layer in on top of that efficiency measures, which is how output to input ratios are your efficiency at that stage and the effectiveness of the outputs that are affecting the outcome as the efficiency at that stage.
You know, bringing in the theoretical is almost like the logic model concept.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But as you're title of your report conveys, your research focuses on measuring so-called unobserved events. Would you explain what they are and how do they differ from infrequent events?
So we're really talking about things where you know it's going on, but unobserved to the, from the perspective of the law enforcement organization, from the government entity and tasked with dealing with the challenge. In the report I make, bring out to some extent the difference between infrequent events. I also have a background at Department of Defense where I've worked for a number of years. And there the big challenge was the good fact that wars don't happen very often. So you're investing in ground force capability, you're investing in air forces and afloat forces and ships, and you're trying to design them and buy the optimal mix of those things to affect the ability of the Department of Defense to prosecute the nation's wars. Well, fortunately, those wars don't come around very often. And so a lot of that is you're dealing with, well, if the war occurs, how will it occur, and will this be the best mix of capabilities, or would some other mix be better? That problem is at DHS as well. FEMA is responsible for preparing for a catastrophic event, a nuclear device, an improvised nuclear device going off in a U.S. city. Thank goodness that's never happened. So how do you invest in capabilities and how do you decide, is this the right set of capabilities or is this the right set of capabilities to deal with that problem if and when it occurs? So that's the challenge of infrequent events. And it creates a certain set of measurement challenges for the performance management community. Can't observe what those values are at the government level, at the law enforcement official level. So this is about how to go out and measure things that are going on out there in the field that you don't observe, and how do you create those estimates so that you can then inform your management decision making?
One of the things I found out about your report when I was reading it was that it is sort of the title kind of conveys a little bit something esoteric technical, mm-hmm. and yet your research is very practical. Mm-hmm. You're able to draw people's attention, and I think, by making it realistic and applying it to real life. And one thing I found very interesting is the outcome, performance outcome measures for law enforcement. Could you give us a sense of what they are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I make a point in the report to say measuring performance in federal law enforcement is very challenging, getting at these unobserved events and the like. And that's, you know, in part some of the purpose of the report is to talk about how to do it. But I also make the point that there are some certain advantages. Law enforcement has a relatively straightforward performance management framework. So we kind of know what it is we need to try to be measuring, even if it's hard to get at and actually measure it. And so the report is focused on outcomes, is focused at the leadership of an agency level. And so at that level, if you're in charge of a law enforcement capability and charged with enforcing law X, your outcome performance measure is, well, what's the rate of violation of law X? It's actually relatively straightforward. So if you're convert this to the state and local level. So you're the chief of police of New York City. You're responsible for the murder, the rape, the robbery, the aggravated assault, the property crime rates, et cetera, within the city of New York. Now, if there's people above the police chief, the mayor, the others that deal in the senior levels of the city government, they're probably concerned about what's the quality of life in my city, what's the income levels of my city, how are people feeling, and are they moving into or out of the city, et cetera. Those are affected by the crime rates. And so echelons above the police commissioner have higher level objectives. And then echelons below the police chief have different objectives. If you're the officer in charge of the 911 call system, you're concerned about response rates to 911 calls. If you're the scheduling officer for police officers, you're worried about how much coverage do I have? Is there a law enforcement presence on the streets? Is that presence distributed evenly? Do people see the law enforcement officers on the street? So, you know, there's lots of different objectives at different levels of the organization. But the focus level of my report at the kind of the leadership levels of the law enforcement organizations of government, it's a relatively straightforward thing to identify what outcomes they're accountable for. And then I translate that in the report to the federal level. And so to continue with the immigration example, if you're in charge of the Department of Homeland Security and its subordinate components, Customs and Border Protection, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the United States Coast Guard, all the other Citizenship and Immigration Service, all the other organizations within DHS that are responsible for enforcing our nation's immigration laws, then one of your key outcome measures is the rate at which these laws are broken. If you go up an echelon, you know, go to the White House, go to the policy councils around the president, they're concerned with, well, okay, if my immigration laws are broken at a certain rate, what does that do to security, to national security and homeland security? If they're broken at a certain rate, what does that do to economic growth, things like that? So you know, you go up the chain. You have higher level, broader objectives. And then if you go down the chain, if you're within CBP, if you're in charge of a particular sector of the border, you're concerned about what's going on in that sector. How much situational awareness do I have? How am I scheduling my agents, et cetera? But the level of my report focusing on that senior leadership level of the law enforcement organizations, we kind of know what the outcomes we're trying to achieve are. You're responsible for law enforcement. What's the rate at which those laws are broken?
Thanks, John. I'm here with John Whitley, author of the IBM Center Report, Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events, a case study of federal law enforcement. So keeping on the idea of the outcomes, I'd like for you to briefly examine the output, input, and efficiency measures that can be used to implement strategies that make you achieve those outcomes. Would you do that?
I take a very simple, you know, kind of logic model approach. So you're in charge of a sector of the border. You're in charge of Customs and Border Protection. You're trying to produce a level of border control, border security. And you produce that with various inputs. You have agents. You have tactical infrastructure. So you have these inputs. These inputs produce various outputs, situational awareness within a sector, the ability to make apprehensions within a sector, et cetera. And those are affecting an outcome, the flow rate, the rate at which people are coming across the border. You're efficient. You have efficiency measures. Given level of situational awareness, is it more efficient to do that with more people or more tactical infrastructure or more technology? Nobody has all the resources they want. Leadership have to make choices about how they're going to achieve their objectives. And so if you're not measuring these things and if you don't understand this logic model framework, if you don't understand how inputs affect outputs, how outputs affect outcomes, the efficiency of one input versus another input in affecting and producing an output, then you really don't have the data you need to be selecting among these different ways in which you can execute your program.
You point out in your research for your report for the IBM Center that improving the availability of objective and transparent performance outcome data would improve management line management decision making. Mm-hmm. How does it help folks make clear policy objectives and select the right strategies?
Immigration is very contentious in our country today, illegal immigration, how much enforcement we should have, what we should do with the resident undocumented population in the country. There's ongoing negotiations in the Congress about what should we try another comprehensive immigration reform effort. So the first point I make is just at the strategic level, at the Congress and the president level, setting policy objectives. What's an acceptable level of control of the border? What's an acceptable flow rate? What's an acceptable apprehension rate? Those types of things. Now let's put the technicians in place and say, now what's the best way to achieve that? What's the lowest cost, most efficient way to achieve that? And not have the senior policy folks instead controlling the inputs of the process because there's no agreement on what the outcomes are and what the outcomes should be. Focus them on the outcomes. Let the technicians then start to work down on setting strategies. I also briefly mention how you manage execution. It's hard to do that when you're not measuring these things and when you don't have a good handle on them. And the ultimate, of course, is in accountability. And so when you're measuring these things, you can then hold people. You can now go down all the way down to the line level and hold people accountable for the results that are achieved.
You mentioned proxy just before in your response, and I want to actually explore that a little bit. What are some of the challenges in estimating performance and the problems created when you use or reference a non-outcome proxy measure?
Well, and law enforcement provides great examples of these because perhaps the most common proxy used in law enforcement is the arrest rate. And they're certainly an important thing to measure. But they don't necessarily tell you what's going on in terms of the underlying crime rate. People feel more secure in their home when crime rates are low, and they feel less secure in their home when crime rates are high. And knowing that you've arrested a lot of people doesn't necessarily tell you which case you're in. That's just one example, but it's an example where an important output measure that should be measured, but sometimes is mistakenly put forward as an outcome, and it clouds the debate instead of clarifying the debate.
Are there data estimation methods that can assist public managers in measuring unobserved events? We will explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? What is being done to ensure the safety and soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative new technologies and open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with John Whitley, author of the IBM Center report, Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events, a case study of federal law enforcement. So, John, I want to keep on that example of the immigration enforcement example from the last segment. Would you tell us about the DHS Southwest border example that you have in your report? What are some of the challenges faced, and how did the department address some of the issues they dealt with there?
Mm-hmm. This is an example of where proxy measure was developed, and it ended up, at the end of the day, not advancing us forward as much as we'd liked. And this is the operational control measure that the Department of Homeland Security has been reporting for approximately 6 or so years. This was an attempt by serious folks who are trying to get a handle on the problem to say, how can we go out and measure this thing? The challenge they faced is it's unobservable. Mm-hmm. The flow rate, the apprehension rates, all these things are unobservable. So they said, what can we measure? And so they developed this operational control measure. It's meant to aggregate up different things. That, you know, how many resources have I expended on the border? What's the judgment of the sector chief and the station chief? What's their judgment in terms of how well controlled the border is? And so it tried to aggregate these things in a kind of a qualitative way and create this thing. Do I have operational control of this section of the border or not? So it was, again, you know, serious folks trying to get a handle on the problem. But unfortunately, what we found out now after years of trying to use this measure to inform decisions and trying to inform policy debates, that it really just hasn't worked. And so what I draw out in the paper is the fact that, you know, doing that was not costless. It took resources, but it was easily in the millions of dollars over a period of years to develop this measure. And the measure ultimately didn't get at what we needed it to get at. And so what I do is talk about proxies are sometimes necessary. Proxies are sometimes important. But you have to think long and hard.
Well, I'd like to discuss those methods and really explore what they actually are practically. And you do a wonderful job in your report. So the first one, would you tell us about the estimating unobserved events, the first method that you tackle, and perhaps you could give us an example of its use and benefits?
Mm-hmm. Before I invest resources in new methods and developing new data and trying to do something complicated and new, first thing to do is let's see what do we have already. So what does your agency have? What are all the data sets available that you have at different levels? What's available at headquarters? What's available down in the field? What data is available from other sources, other agencies? All of them have wide ranges of data. And so I draw an example of that where a clever use of already available administrative records can get you pretty close. It doesn't get you all the way there, but it can get you pretty close to an estimate of the flow rate of that illegal immigration. And it's called the recidivism approach. And CBP does this. Customs and Border Protection does this now. The good news is here's a simple mathematical technique. Now, you can make it very complicated statistically, and the analysts have all done that at CBP. But conceptually, a very simple technique that gets at, that takes existing data that we already have, that we're already collecting in the course of our day-to-day operations, and allows us to impute something about this unobserved outcome. That's good news. Bad news is it doesn't get you all the way there. And so some of the other methods in the report would have to be augmented to that. The biggest challenge is we know that some fraction of those 100,000 will be deterred and will not try again. So you have to control for deterrence somehow. And so some of the other techniques may help you control for deterrence. So you may have to combine multiple techniques together to ultimately get at the outcome. But this also gives us a place that we could use our example of bias. So what if that 100,000, though, what if there's really 200,000 or 300,000 going across, and we've apprehended 100,000 of them? What if that 100,000 is not representative of the total population that goes across? What if that 100,000 were the ones that, for whatever reason, chose not to or couldn't afford assistance, a smuggler to help them get across, and the others do? So in that case, this may not be a representative sample of the underlying population. And in fact, if this is the population that's this is a subset of the population that's disproportionately more likely to get apprehended, then you would be underestimating the total flow if you use that to infer things about the total population. So one, it's an example of bias and why you have to think through what the different implications of your data are. But coming back to the broader point, it's an example of how you can take currently available data and do relatively simple analysis on it to infer things about the population. So that's one of the examples provided in the report about how to use administrative records and the data that you might have available already to try and impute things about these unobserved events.
So the first method that you explore is the use of administrative data. The second method you explore is the use of surveys. Mm-hmm. Would you tell us more about the proper use and application of surveys? Mm-hmm. And perhaps you can give us an example of its use and what are some of the benefits and challenges of using surveys?
Yep. Surveys are a good example in law enforcement because at the state and local level, because there's a very important survey done there called the National Crime Victimization Survey. And so it's a well-used and well-known example within law enforcement already. And at the state and local level, one of the issues they have there is we talked about the fact that state and locals have a slightly easier time in measuring some of these things in the sense that there's an aggrieved victim oftentimes that comes forward to report the crime. But that's not perfect. So even at the state and local level, there's challenges in measuring their crime rates. And so one of the purposes of the National Crime Victimization Survey is to go out and say, we have a measure of the assault rate based on reported assaults. But what if we go out and survey people and ask, have you ever been a victim of assault or in the last 12 months or in the last whatever, have you been a victim of an assault? And compare the numbers and see, are we missing anything? Are there people who didn't come forward? Are there different groups of people, perhaps socioeconomically depressed people who don't come forward, they don't trust the police or something like that? This is a way to get at trying to understand that and validate the data and confirm the data. So the first thing to say about surveys are they're well known and used in law enforcement settings already. Now, my report is about federal law enforcement. What I try to say is it's another technique that should be added into the mix. And I'll give an example in just a minute of how it can be used. But you said, what are some of the challenges and other things with using surveys? So a big challenge is you got to solicit truthful responses. And if you're going out and asking people, did you commit a crime? You might have reason to believe they're not going to answer truthfully, even if it's an anonymous phone call. I mean, you know, people are not going to necessarily answer that question truthfully. And so you have to be careful with surveys. Surveys are very useful because you control just about everything about it. You control the setting. You can control who gets asked the questions. You can control what asked. So it gives you a great deal of flexibility to go in and tailor a solution to meet your needs. But you have to be careful with surveys, so that's the good. The bad is you have to be careful because in a law enforcement setting, getting truthful answers can be challenging. Now, survey experts and people who specialize in designing surveys have developed a lot of techniques to try and get it. Truthful answers. And the way you ask questions, you ask repeat questions, you delay for a period of time asking other questions, then you come back to the question, and you can get at either A, trying to elicit a truthful response, or B, trying to evaluate the truthfulness by asking corroborating or supporting questions later in the survey so you get a sense of what's the error rate or what the misreporting rate might be in your survey. So there are challenges, but in many cases, these challenges at least can be partially overcome by employing and enlisting experts in the use of surveys. Now, coming back to an example, we gave the example of how you use administrative records to the recidivism method of looking at repeat offenders to see if you could tease out from your apprehension data an estimate of apprehension rates and flow. The challenge was there was this deterrent effect. Well, surveys could be a good tool to go and investigate that deterrent effect. And in fact, there are a number of, in particular, Mexican household surveys that are done now. There's two large ones done by different groups. And that data can be analyzed to look at, to try to get at an estimate of this deterrent effect. And so then when you can combine the two methods, you're able to get at a reasonably reliable estimate of apprehension and flow rates. Administrative records, the recidivism approach by itself, doesn't necessarily get you all the way there. Survey methods by themselves wouldn't necessarily get you all the way. But when you combine the two, you can actually start to create a reliable estimate. And there was actually on that, serendipitously, I had written this report in a National Academy of the Sciences study actually just came out. And basically they approached the problem slightly differently than I did, but they basically came out with that recommendation. You combine the recidivism with the surveys, and that might be the most profitable way to get at measuring these rates.
So, John, the title of your report for the IBM Center is Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events. We've done the first two, the use of administrative data, surveys, and I understand from your report that criminal or administrative investigations mm-hmm. offer another way to systematically collect an accurate data sample. Yeah. Would you explain the third method you identify and unfold in your report and perhaps give us an example of its use?
Yep. So a lot of law enforcement activity in the federal government is not reactive. I get a crime's committed. I go out and try to make it. A lot of it is proactive. We're going out and we're investigating, and we're going out and we're inspecting. We're going out and we're auditing. We're going out and we're trying to get these things. Now, in the typical course of activity in these areas, we generally prioritize. Where am I going to go out and investigate? Where am I going to go out and inspect or audit? Well, I'm going to go out where I think I have the highest probability of uncovering something wrong. And I'm going to try to target those investigations, target those audits to the highest probability payoff, where I'm going to get the biggest disruption of activity. And so what I talk about in the report is, obviously, that's important. Obviously, that's how the bulk of these activities are managed. But you can use these activities to try and get information about the underlying environment in which you're working in. And when you want to do it that way for that purpose, you got to take a slightly different approach. So if you want to use those tools can be very useful in estimating underlying rates of noncompliance or crime rates. But in that case, you have to do kind of randomized investigations, randomized inspections, randomized audits. Now, the law enforcement folks who listen to this program are on the edge of their seat right now. But the thing to tell them is we do that already. So this isn't unheard of. People understand this. So why do you have to do them random and not just follow the best lead? Well, it gets back to that statistical framework. We need an unbiased estimate. And if we only follow the most promising leads, we're only looking at a subset of the population. And we want to get at an estimate of the total population. So what are some examples where we do this today? We do randomized inspections or audits or investigations to try and get at what's going on in the population as a whole and how is that valuable to decision makers. CIS, Citizenship and Immigration Service, part of Department of Homeland Security. They're responsible for visa compliance and issuing visas. And one challenge, particularly after 9/11, after 2001, the terrorist attacks, was one category of visas are religious worker visas. So a religious institution sponsors somebody to come to the U.S. and work in the religious institution. There was concern that that could be exploited and that might be disproportionately vulnerable. So what CIS does, what they started, they were doing it, but what they've did more systematically following 9/11 was to say, well, we need to know, are these things being exploited? So they inspect those when applications come in. They systematically inspect the visa application, which means going to the site. Does this religious institution actually exist? If the visa has already been issued, did the person actually show up? Is the person actually there? Can I find that person? And they didn't do that in terms of which ones are the most suspect applications. They said, I'm going to visit a fraction of all of them, and I'm going to estimate the fraction, the probability that one of these is nefarious. And so they do that, and that's actually now a performance measure that they report. And it helps them now target which ones do I go after and how do I do this. Another example is the IRS. IRS, everybody loves to get an IRS audit. Well, most of IRS's audits are targeted at where they have suspicion that something's going on. But they do another subset of audits that are randomly selected. This consumes resources. Sometimes it's kind of hard for law enforcement officials to wrap their head around. So I'm going to take my scarce resources and send them out to investigate things that I don't necessarily think are likely to be nefarious or wrong. But in the IRS's case, what this allows them to do is revise their tools for targeting. So I go out and I do this random sample of returns and I audit them and I find out what the violation rates are. So one, it allows me to estimate the overall violation rate. But two, it allows me to refine my tools and say, here are the tools that the forensic tools I was using to try to go after the most likely problematic returns. But I found out I'm missing something. Here's a set of things that weren't in my targeting tools, and I have to add them to my set of targeting tools. So it also, not only does it help the performance manager, not only help the senior leadership get a sense of what's going on out there, it can be used to also help refine and target and retool the selection and the criteria for investigating already.
Thanks, John. I'm here with John Whitley, author of the IBM Center Report, Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events, a case study of federal law enforcement. So, John, another method involves adding or modifying activities in the field to sort of facilitate an estimation of crime rate. Would you tell us more about the proper application of experimental methods in real life?
Yep.
And what are some of the benefits and challenges?
So there's a couple of great examples in this area. One, perhaps the most obvious, is red teaming or covert testing. So this is just taking somebody that works for us, that works for the good guys, and just sending them out into an environment to pretend to be the bad guy and see if they get caught. So one of the best-run programs on this in the federal government right now is TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. They have a very systematic and thorough red teaming program for airline security. They're trying to send individuals through the screening environment with different types of violations to see if they can get through. Now, the details of that, they tend to keep kind of close hold, but they have made public that they have this program, and it's a very systematic and thorough program. And one key part about it, there's actually two elements of the program, and one key element of the program is one set of red teamings that they do is for performance measurement. So it's a high volume. I send lots of people through with standardized violations, and I see what's the probability that they get through, what's the fraction they get through. And I'm able to estimate my failure rate at my screening points there. So red teaming, covert testing has a lot of different applications. When the private sector does this at a store, they call it mystery shoppers sometimes. They'll just send somebody in. I have a retail outlet. I have to figure out, is that retail outlet doing its job? Is it serving the customers? I'm corporate headquarters. I'll just send somebody in anonymously to pretend to be a customer. So lots of situations like that. We could send dummy applications through the visa process and see if they get accepted or not. A second area, another example in the government of a similar broad thing but different in application, is what CBP does, Customs and Border Protection. They also – I've talked a lot about them in the context of between the ports border control, the southwest land border and things like that. CBP also runs the ports of entry, so the airports, the maritime ports, the land ports where somebody comes in, presents their passport, enters the country. Well, everybody that comes in presents to an officer and gets screened, and that we call that the primary screen. And if anybody fails the primary screen, we send them to a secondary screen, and they get investigated more thoroughly there. But what if we took a random sample, and so CBP does this, what if we took a random sample of people who passed the primary screen, send them into the secondary screen, a more rigorous screen, and then find out how many violations we detect in the secondary, this more rigorous screen, that were passed through that were not detected in the primary screen. And if you do that, and CBP does that, then what you can do is you can impute backwards then what's the failure rate of your primary screen. And they do that, and they report violation rates at the ports of entry based on that.
So you have a final method that you unfold in your report, but you acknowledge there are many more methods, but the report focuses on five. So the last one is technical data collection or technical management or measurement, rather. Would you tell us more about this method, and what are some of the well-known examples of it in action?
So probably the most well-known very well-known example to everybody is simply a red light camera or a speeding camera, any types of physical collection that we see out at the state and local level. So what I do in the report is provide some examples of where it's done, already done at the federal level, and where it might be also be considered at the federal level. So one thing that the United States Secret Service is responsible for is the integrity of our currency, counterfeiting, and trying to detect and reduce counterfeiting. Well, the Secret Service, they go out and they do apprehend a certain amount and capture a certain amount of counterfeit currency, and others, convenience store owners, can detect the lower end of the counterfeiting and turn that in to folks as well. But a large fraction of the counterfeit detection, the amount of currency in circulation that's counterfeit, well, bills move around in the economy, and they pretty much pretty regularly get cycled through the Federal Reserve System. And the Federal Reserve System just uses computer sensors. All these bills go through. They get counted. They get the quality of them, and if they're deteriorated, they get removed, and other bills get inserted and all these things. Well, they detect for counterfeiting there. So we run all the currency, and because the currency moves around in the economy, I give it to you, you give it to a convenience store, the convenience store gives it to the bank, bank runs it through the Fed. The currency at a pretty high rate cycles through the Federal Reserve System. Federal Reserve System runs all that currency through mechanical detection devices to determine if it's counterfeit or not. And from that, the Secret Service then takes that, how much gets apprehended in that system, how much gets taken out detected through that system, then how much do they apprehend and how much gets turned in other venues. They combine all that together, all the different ways it comes in, and they create a total measure of counterfeit currency in circulation. And they actually report that as a performance measure. Another example that I cite in the report is drugs. Drugs are an issue that overlaps state, local, and federal jurisdiction. One area that's important to federal law enforcement is the smuggling and the importation, the movement of drugs into the country from out of the country. And so the government, this is an interagency, a very robust effort across several agencies, has for years done very sophisticated estimates of what's the total flow of drugs coming up into the country. And so that starts with satellite imagery and other types of imagery of cultivation, how much is being grown in the source countries. Then they watch through and they can impute from that how much of that will get harvested. They can follow weather. They can do other things of that. Then it gets harvested. How much product does that get converted into, produced into in the labs? And then you combine that with Coast Guard patrolling of the maritime smuggling routes and CBP data and intelligence from the land smuggling routes and the like. And then you can say, well, so how much of that made it and got targeted for the U.S., and then how much did we actually apprehend at the border? And then so you can say how much is probably getting in that's evading apprehension at the border. So it's another way where there's a lot of different techniques used, but it all starts actually with imagery and technical collection, and then the evaluation of that imagery and the analysis of it.
Well, John, you point out and admit that there's no simple formula to identifying the right methods for performance managers to use. Each measurement challenge is different, and the best methods vary with the circumstances of the individual challenge. However, your report offers a few rules of thumb that can be used to structure the selection of a method. Mm-hmm. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah. As you said, there is no cookie-cutter formula to go in and say, I work in mission space X, so technique Y is the right one for me. But what you can say is, first, you have to start with what is your performance management framework. You have to start with the logic model and say, what is my mission space? How is my mission space defined? So you have to know what you're trying to measure. And so a lot of the challenges we face are, if you don't do that homework first, then it turns into an exercise of what can I measure? And then you realize years later, after you've spent a lot of money and made a lot of bad decisions, that you were going in the wrong direction. So you have to start with the logic model and the analysis. What is my mission? What are the mission outcomes I'm trying to affect? And that's what you should be at least trying. Sometimes you won't succeed, but at least trying to measure. Okay, so now that you know what you need to measure, start with, okay, well, what data is available? So that was a conversation we had on the administrative records. What does my agency capture? Well, already, what's captured at the headquarters level and systems? What's down at the field level? What do we have? And is there any way to combine what we have already to use? And then look around to others. So, you know, Bureau of Labor Statistics, Department of Commerce, Department of Labor, all these organizations collect reams and mountains of data. Is there ways that we can use that, compile that? Also, look around to what's going on, academia, think tanks, NGOs, et cetera. An example I use in the paper at this point in the report is to talk about, think through, if you've got that logic model, a good thing about laying out that logic model and thinking through is, say, well, is there an aggrieved victim somewhere? Even if they don't necessarily have an incentive to report or is not a collection, you know, is an aggrieved. So I actually go through an example of credit card and bank fraud. This is an important area of responsibility of the U.S. Secret Service, part of the Department of Homeland Security. They go out and they investigate bank fraud, credit card fraud, et cetera. Very hard to measure how much is going on out there. Millions of transactions, you know, very complicated marketplace. Not transparent. There's not a single clearinghouse for every transaction. They're highly decentralized. But there is an aggrieved victim, the credit card companies, the banks. When somebody commits a fraud against them, they lose money. So what do they do? Preparing the report, I just did a little bit of – I'm not an expert in that area, but I just did a little bit of digging. And sure enough, the banks were trying to measure it. And sure enough, they – not surprisingly, they had professional associations across banks that were trying to help them measure it and trying to consolidate the data across the banks. So another point to make is think through the problem and think through who's got an incentive. Is there somebody out there with an incentive, with the data and an incentive to be measuring the problem already?
We'll explore the challenges outlined in John Whitley's IBM Center report, Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events, when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with John Whitley, author of the IBM Center report, Five Methods for Measuring Unobserved Events, a case study of federal law enforcement. So, John, I want to know a little bit more about yourself. Could you tell me about your background and what prompted your interest in this research area?
I'm an economist by training, and I've worked most of my professional career in the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security. And so as I alluded to earlier, I came on these issues from a very pragmatic practitioner. My job was to offer to the secretary advice and analysis on how he or she should be spending their money. And so if I didn't have these measures, then I wasn't able to really provide recommendations that were grounded in data and analysis there. So the specifics to this report then came from my experience at the Department of Homeland Security. I was a performance improvement officer there, and I also was responsible for the resource allocation process, so owning how the decision-making process by which the secretary and deputy secretary chose how to allocate their resources. The Department of Homeland Security is a very large law enforcement organization, and these types of problems were just riddled through our day-to-day work. And so we were seriously hamstrung. The folks there are working incredibly hard and really trying to get at what's the right thing to do for the taxpayer. And we were just – we would run up against this brick wall of, but I just don't know. I don't see it. I just don't know. So when I had an opportunity, when I left the Department of Homeland Security and went to where I work now currently at the Institute for Defense Analyses, and I had time to take a more analytic approach to these problems, and you know, I did – I had the pressure of the day-to-day action items lifted off my desk, I had the idea of what I'd like to do is really write down kind of how we could start approaching these problems and hopefully write it in a way. I apply it very much to law enforcement. I apply it very much to the law enforcement parts that fall in DHS. That's where my background is. But hopefully it applies to more broadly to law enforcement, to FBI and others, to the whole Department of Justice mission space, but even beyond law enforcement, to anywhere folks in government or in other settings are dealing with problems of, I know what the outcome is. I've done my logic model. I know what I'm trying to measure. The problem is I just don't see that. There's no way that the federal government can observe 100% of those cases and create administrative records that I can add together. So how do I get at trying to estimate what's going on out there?
So your report explores five methods for measuring unobserved events, but it also identifies five specific challenges that are particularly relevant to the law enforcement space. Mm-hmm. And the first challenge is institutional resistance. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I'll word this delicately. I mean, you know, our law enforcement officials out there and you know, those of you who have worked with them, you know that these are incredibly dedicated public servants. But they're generally folks who are very focused on doing their job today, this minute. What's my lead? Where could it take me? What arrests could I make? How can I get the bad guy put away? The notion that some of your resources should not be devoted to that, that some of your resources should be withheld and devoted to getting a better handle on what's going on in the environment in which you're operating in, and to measure it, to develop performance measures, and then to use these performance measures to inform investment decisions, bringing new officers on board in the future, bringing new technologies on board in the future, doing whatever it is, or rearranging from this investigative portfolio to that investigative portfolio, things that will happen next year or the year after, multi-years from now. That tends to be a little foreign to the folks. I've also spent a lot of my career in the Department of Defense. And it's interesting how the Department of Defense has worked this through time, because they wrestled with this same problem. And they have a very specific career progression where if you're an officer rising up through the ranks in the United States military, you have to do a certain number of staff tours and at headquarters levels and in strategic planning or in investment planning or in acquisition and other places where you have to start to see what some of the challenges that the secretary and deputy secretary face are. Secretary and deputy secretary are trying to say, how do I build the military of tomorrow, as well as conduct the operations today? And so I think, you know, through time, this process in the Department of Defense has created an officer corps that has a much broader appreciation for the full range of challenges a senior leader faces and why taking money out of current operations today is sometimes optimal if it's going to allow me to build a better force for tomorrow or make better planning decisions about how to operate that force tomorrow. And so the law enforcement community, I think, is less mature in that area. They haven't quite gotten to that level of sophistication where people are really being grown up through the ranks to understand the full range of challenges that face the senior leadership in trying to organize her and get those folks as effective as possible. So that's why I think you run to a little more resistance in the law enforcement community to the notion that every penny we get isn't necessarily – it's not necessarily optimal to put every penny we get into making the next apprehension as quickly as possible, that sometimes you need to take a step back and sometimes some of those resources need to go into these other areas.
Your second challenge centers around the issue of data quality, which I think transcends mm-hmm. law enforcement or any particular area of interest. Would you tell us more about this challenge and what are some insights that you have for overcoming it?
This, to some extent, this was my attempt to be even-handed in a report. Yeah. So if I just criticized the operators. Now I need to criticize the performance management office and the analysts that sit there. If the operators are sometimes too reluctant to invest in this, sometimes the performance managers and the analysts are sometimes too eager and sometimes are not. And the tendency is going to be to downplay the challenges with the data and to not be as transparent as it need to be. About. So this is just a reminder to the analytic community to say we're estimating very complicated things. Our estimates are not perfect, and everybody knows our estimates are not perfect. We need to be very upfront with folks what the limitations are. If we think there's systematic bias in one way or the other, explain how that might be creeping in. If there's ways we can control for it, explain how it is you're going to try to control for it in the future. Explain what the limitations are. Explain what you're not including in the data, what you're not including in the model. All that has to be just very upfront. So what I talk about in the report is largely about communicating those things. You know, the statistical pieces of how do you measure the quality of your data, how do you measure the confidence interval around your estimates. You know, that's not as much in the report, but, I mean, that's important, too. And I urge folks, if they don't understand those, if they're not familiar with those techniques themselves, they need to get somebody on the staff who can do that. But what I really talk about in the report is you really need to be upfront with the leadership about what the strengths and weaknesses of the data that you're bringing forward are. Decisions are complicated to make, are hard to make. The reason the secretary and deputy secretary get paid a lot of money is because they're doing a really hard job. The data is never going to be sufficiently complete. The analysis is never going to be sufficiently comprehensive and of sufficient quality that it's the only thing that helps determine the decision. There's other factors, professional judgment of the operators, the political environment in which you're working, the broader strategic agenda of the administration, all those things are going to be part of the decision, and they all should be part of the decision. The data should be an important part, but it won't be the only part. And so the performance management office, they need to be aggressive, and they need to get the data collected, get the data, get the analysis done, and get the data in front of the decision maker. But they also need to be constrained in terms of what they're saying it can do.
So, John, the first challenge was institutional resistance. The second challenge was data quality. And now the third challenge is the cultural change that comes with quantifying a problem for the first time. Why is this a challenge? Could you explain?
We've talked a lot about immigration, and we don't know. The Department of Homeland Security doesn't know. I, as an analyst, doesn't know what the apprehension and flow rates are on the Southwest land border. But we can speculate. I mean, there have been academic studies, the techniques I talked about before the recidivism. It's probably somewhere in the 40 to 50, 55% range. That's the fraction that are apprehended. And then to get the flow rate in any given year, you can do simple math to estimate the ultimate outcome there. Some people think it should be much higher. Some people think it's much lower. It could be a shock to people to actually put that number forward. So what this challenge is talking about is you have to be – if you're a performance manager, you have to be sensitive to what people's expectations are, how the data is going to be received, what it's going to mean to folks. So if there's a group of people, if there's a group of people in the Congress, if your secretary thinks that that rate should be 100% and you're going to come forward and say it's 45%, you're going to have to think through – simply putting that on the first slide and sending that slide up and saying, here, I'm done my work. Use this now. You know, there's probably a little more to it. One thing I suggest in the paper, or I've suggested in other venues as well, is try to put that in the context. You know, well, what is the apprehension? What's the equivalent measure for violent crime in the country? 50 to 60%. A lot of assaults, a lot of rapes, a lot of burglaries go unresolved. What's the closure rate for property crime in the country? Actually quite a bit lower than 45%. Maybe if you put it in that context and you say, so what we're doing on the border is kind of in between where we're at for violent crime and property crime in the country. I don't know if that's the right answer. That's for policymakers to decide. But putting it in that context may help make this more palatable the first time. These are people who have devoted their entire lives to this problem but have never measured it before. They have their own preconceived notions about what the answer is and what the answer should be. Be sensitive about that and try to put it in the context and bring in other bits of data as relevant to help explain the information.
Your fourth challenge acknowledges that performance management sits at the intersection of operators mm-hmm. and analysts. What do you mean by this statement, and why is it a challenge?
So it comes back to a point I was making earlier on the data quality. This is where decisions I'm from the analytic side of the world, so that's my background, and I like to think that my models and my estimations and my data are the best thing and should be the sole driver of decision. Operators that don't have an analytic background think that their professional experience and judgment from boots on the ground, from years and years of boots on the ground, should be the sole determinant of the decision. We can expand the pool of people and talk about what their background is and why they think their background is the most important for making this decision. So what this is trying to illustrate and emphasize to folks is the point I made a few minutes ago. Decision makers have to take all that information. They have to take the professional judgment of the boots on the ground operator. They have to take what the data and the analysis are showing. They have to take what the political environment is. They have to take what the strategic objectives are. They have to take all that into account, and they have to make a decision. The data and the analysis should be a very important driver of that decision. They will never be the sole determinant of that decision. And so the performance side needs to understand that. The